Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 121, and they call it Democracy Part 4. Part 4 is wrapping up this series of this show based on the book Democracy Incorporated, Managed Democracy and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism by Sheldon S. Wolin. The title of the show is from Bruce Coburn's song, Call It Democracy. Bit of an editorializing footnote to the series is that the word democracy, demos, the people, from the ancient Greek, and the democracy, the government of the people, by the people, for the people. Yet, we need to look and think and act outside the box, because what is the definition of people? We look to the native cultures, and they have the one-leggeds, the tree people, and all the various nature beings and relations, and that is the wider democracy. A while back, I recall reading a story, something, a true story of Gary Snyder, perhaps, hiking in the mountains in Washington, and somebody saying, is there a senator for all this? And the point was that we as the people help to represent and be a voice for all the relations. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Going to start by reading this short paragraph. This greatest disturbance results from the opposition between political sovereignty of varying degrees and the private sovereignty of private corporations. They are not usually considered sovereignties, but rather private interests. This conception belongs to the past, since the hierarchy of power has been reversed. If only to express our indignation or concern for this change, we are now obliged to say that corporate sovereignty comes first, and the interests of the state last. Now, that is a little trick start here. This is not from Wolin's book, but this is from a 2002 book by Alain Jouxe, J-O-X-E, if that's the way to pronounce it, a French author. The book is L'Empire du Chaos, translated as Empire of Disorder. And at first read of that phrase numerous times in Pepe Escobar's essays referring to the Empire of Chaos. Interesting in and of itself. In Jouxe's book, he mentions a bit of you know, it used to be geopolitics and wars and stuff were the goal was to conquer people, but nowadays it's sort of like the goal is not to conquer them. I mean, if you look at, you know, the ongoing stuff in Iraq, Afghanistan, etc., it's more to cause chaos than to conquer. And so that's a whole nother side angle, but I wanted to start with that because I'm about two-thirds of the way through Jokes' book, and he makes some very interesting parallels to Wolin's inverted totalitarianism on a global corporate empire scale. So I just found that fascinating. And he also has various references, just to briefly mention electronic fascism, which again, similar to Wolin's, highlighting technology as a major force in determining things. And another one he dubs unconscious fascism. The contemptuous post or neo-colonial mindset displayed by mediocre leaders often hastens these crises towards the worst catastrophes, which they follow with a sort of schadenfreude, a neo-Darwinian pleasure in watching others suffer, close to an unconscious fascism valid for the exterior. And then also mentions a smiling neo-fascism and a global fascism. So again, just an interesting connection between coming from different angles. So now actually back to Wolin's book, where he is talking about the globalizing capitalism and its managers. Conservative intellectuals date the beginnings of the modern Republican Party from the presidential campaign of Barry Goldwater in 1964. That happens to have been when conservative intellectuals first played an influential political role. By the time that the party returned to power in 1980, it had become increasingly radicalized and its reactionary elements converted into a political dynamic symbolized by managerialists such as Cheney and Rumsfeld. The revelatory moment came when the neocons joined with the managerialists to proclaim the new American century and lay plans for the expansion of American power. So Wolin also goes on to show how throughout U.S. history, these different ways of saying expansionism and the frontier, and how that, you know, started with the Manifest Destiny, which is basically now spread out on a global level. And there's another reference to the frontier. I think I'll come across that in my notes. And another maybe mentioned in the previous show, but he talks about the founding father figures. Theirs was a counter-revolution, not only against the system of politics that had led the revolution against Britain, but against the democratic tendencies and populist outbreaks that had persisted from the end of the 17th century and throughout the 18th. And I want to note on that his whole talk about the demos and democracy. I read a very interesting article at resilience.org by Eileen Christ, C-R-I-S-T, and she seems to come from a very indigenous native people's angle, because she mentions the whole thing about how social justice cannot really happen unless we include the non-human, all the relations. So this whole sense of democracy in the Western sense, even perhaps from Greece, it seems like, I don't know my history that well, but this overlooking of all the relations is a major amiss. And another phrase that came to mind while reading this was demos or domo. The domo being the domination. Stephen Newcomb highlights that in his book Pagans in the Promised Land, the domination that is a sort of this hierarchical structure, the way, you know, conquerors and the way the flags get planted in the land as a way of claiming the land and dominating it rather than working with it. So demos or domo. And Wolin also shows how imperialism, expansionism, etc. erodes democracy. I guess this has been mentioned by other writers throughout the ages, of how empires typically fall is by spreading themselves too thin. So this whole global pitch, although in its way troubling is perhaps, presumably bodes the ending of the empire. And this has also been mentioned in previous shows. First, democracy and capital were occasional political allies pitted against the stratified order of monarchy, aristocracy, and established church. Then, as each became more politically self-conscious, more aware of divergent concerns, each began to define an identity and pursue strategies that reflected the reality of opposed interests. Contrasting conceptions of power and disagreement as to what degree of equality or inequality each could tolerate without compromising their respective systems, basically showing how some of the original democratic values he cites as sharing, caring, and preserving, really what we would expect from a democracy, but how those have gotten lost in the sauce, and how democracy and capitalism at one point were allies, but corporatism got in there big time. Yeah, this next longer bit is quite telling, especially considering nowadays how basically a lot of people have to work to pay bills and have a roof over their head. So that in a way cuts into the amount of people potentially that could protest, although that could change. That contrast between the leisured and the leisureless was literally written into the Constitution. In 1787, many of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, quote, had time, end quote, for politics because they owned slaves whose labor freed their masters for political activity. No working man or ordinary farmer or shopkeeper helped to write the Constitution. The fugitive democracy referred to earlier can be seen as the form of political expression of the leisureless. That politics of protest appeared in revolutionary America, where the politically excluded erupted periodically and took to the streets or relied upon improvised organizations to denounce the political decisions in which their interests and views were unrepresented. There was no single mass, no one demos, only episodic actions. Throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, a fragmented demos, frustrated by the political system devised by the founders, retained the practice of fugitive democracy and eruptive politics. Jacksonian Democrats succeeded in electing their man and gaining a foothold into the system of federal offices. Abolitionist forces agitated for the elimination of slavery. Women pressed for the right to participate in political life. Trade unions were established to protect workers against employers who were often backed by governmental power. Grassroots populists mounted a flurry of protests attacking the power of railroad owners and pressuring legislators to control railroad rates. Early 20th century progressive campaigns successfully for government regulation of the economic power of large monopolies. In the 1950s and 60s, African Americans took to the streets and eventually succeeded in ending racial segregation, vigilante justice, and political exclusion. And throughout the 1960s, spontaneous movements arose to protest the Vietnam War, racism, sexism, environmental degradation, and corporate power, not least for the latter's influence over higher education. Does a demos have a future in the age of globalization, instant communication networks, and fluid borders? Is the notion of a demos as a single compact body with a will and an identity that persists over time at all possible or even a coherent notion in the age of the political bloggers? Is there time for more authentic politics, more reflective of the pluralistic character of reality? Those fugitive moments when the demos acted, challenging the structure of power, even influencing it, were typically the initiatives of a fraction, not of a collective whole. Such holistic notions as we the people are the remains of a day when the people implied the vast majority of persons and the reality of a common pariah status. They were all excluded from politics. And again, looking to the native peoples, where looking up a lot of the meanings of their of the tribal names, a lot of them mean people, the people, the real people, the common people. So again, a reference point for we the people and a consensus. And references to divide and conquer from the get-go. Thus, Madison's plan blocked popular irrationality and its misguided views of self-interest and played off against each other, the self-interest of the various government officials. And another read this stuff and say, these people are too clever. Instead of seeking ways to block the coalescence of diverse interests, they employ the strategy of targeting them with a message. That message, without necessarily promising to bestow the specific benefits the group might want, appeals to some broad value. For instance, a blue-collar Reagan Democrat might be attracted by appeals to patriotism, that are at the same time silent about promoting labor's right to organize. And an interesting bit here, too, talking about sort of a real big shift from the commons. And he writes, in order to suggest what is at stake in the gathering tendencies toward inverted totalitarianism, I want to recall a development that occurred broadly in 16th century England, in which historians refer to as the enclosure movement. By custom, some land was designated commons or open fields to indicate that it was not owned by particular individuals but could be tilled or otherwise used by the local populace. However, wealthy men and nobles proceeded to erect hedges around part of the common and, in effect, to appropriate it and exclude the general and typically poorer population. What had been common was now privatized. Recall that for centuries, politics too had been enclosed and that the demotic moments represented attempts to open it up, to make it, as it were, public land devoted to common purposes. That speaks volumes to nowadays. The privatization of public service and functions manifests the steady evolution of corporate power into a political form, into an integral, even dominant partner with the state. It marks the transformation of American politics and its political culture from a system in which democratic practices and values were, if not defining, at least major contributory elements, to one where the remaining democratic elements of the state and its populist programs are being systematically dismantled. And once in a while, he just has some wonderful phrases. It was no leap of faith from the camp meetings of the 19th century and the Billy Sundays of the 20th to the political savvy televangelist of the 21st century megachurch. The politically savvy televangelist of the 21st century megachurch. And to kind of wrap it up, section I would call solutions. The fugitive democracy just mentioned, and just alluded to with the enclosure moment, the common good, again, demos. People can take what they think of demos or democracy and spin it for their own, you know, for the good of how they perceive it as. And the connection with the native peoples, Mother Earth, and all my relations of the common good and democracy of the plurinational. And Wolin also highlights empathy as one of the solutions. And he also mentions, to become a democrat is to change oneself, to learn how to act collectively as a demos. It requires that the individual go public and thereby help to constitute a public and an open politics, in principle accessible for all to take part in it and visible so that all might see or learn about the deliberations and decision-making occurring in public agencies and institutions. Now, that's something that has inspired, you know, not this, but that principle, not from Wolin, but that principle has inspired my own writings. Is like a lot of people say, to be a voice for the voiceless. So a lot of writers sort of carry that torch of being able to speak up for, you know, those who are underrepresented. And Wolin also cites, instead of necessarily demos, democratic citizenries. The demos will never dominate politically. In an age where identities are potentially plural and changing, a unified demos is no longer possible or even desirable. Instead of a demos, democratic citizenries. Democratic political consciousness, while it may emerge anywhere at any time, is most likely to be nurtured in local, small-scale settings where both the negative consequences of political powerlessness and the positive possibilities of political involvement seem most evident. Further, a vital local democracy can help to bridge the inevitable distance between representative government and its constituencies. There is a genuinely valuable contribution which democracy can make to national politics, but it is dependent upon a politics that is rooted locally, experienced daily, and practiced regularly, not just mobilized spasmodically. So the recent the citizens helping to convince Cuomo to stop fracking in New York, that comes to mind as a kind of local democracy moment that is being seen as helping to shape, you know, other areas and perhaps on a national level. And he also mentions NGOs, non-governmental organizations, alternative media. before just reading the last paragraph of the book, I do along his lines want to highlight that you know, that local level, that brings to mind that quote of Margaret Mead, something like, don't think that a small group of people can't do anything, make change in the world. That's actually what has always made change. So I think that's important in the sort of, I was going to say in the face, but in the faceless of the corporate faceless monster behemoths, whatever you want to call them, there can be a tendency to get discouraged and to figure out how to, you know, to take that on. And, you know, if even if it's worth taking on is a valid question. But, you know, Wolin points to the small scale and the local, and in whatever ways you can, you know, a simple small thing or that it helps to build to the larger networking. And before concluding with the book readings, two paragraphs, I just want to make note of along the local and small actions. I recently got a email thing from change.org saying how many petitions had been successful throughout the year. It was something like, it was 4,000 or 5,000. It was a huge amount, and it was inspiring to be reminded of this. There was one where some kid, I think another country, helped, whatever he did, helped to get medicine he needed. And another one was a young girl who helped to get some nasty ingredient out of all Coca-Cola products. So whether, you know, it's health-related or personal or political, on a large scale, small scale, the internet and the petitions is one way. It's just as an example of what can be done. I'm also reminded of a book, Blessed Unrest by Paul Hawken, where he lists innumerable amounts of organizations working for social justice and this and that. And after I read that book, it just reminded me, oh yeah, if there's any problem, one can just start an organization and do something about it. You know, if for example, a local a river or someplace is on the polluted or about to be polluted, one can start an organization, Stop River Pollution, or River Blessers Organization, or whatever you want to do, whatever you want to call it. But the general idea is that you know, you can do something. And wrapping up here, this is close to the end of the book, where this paragraph, Sheldon Wolin writes, their mentality is expansionist. This is talking about the elite, the political and corporate elites. Their mentality is expansionist, opportunistic, and above all, exploitative. It exhausts resources, natural, human, public. It is not just the Earth's atmosphere that is being destroyed or human beings who are burned out at 50. Public institutions are being savaged. A legislature, a court, a system of law, a civil service are the equivalent of a public ecology and, like the natural world, an inheritance to be cared for and passed on. They can easily be used up by, for example, corruption, partisanship in the wrong places, denigration of public servants, dismissal of scientific evidence, and the reports of whistleblowers, systematic lying to the public, and the stretching of legal authority to the point where it sanctions torture. So some of what he's saying is, you know, even within the system, one has to keep an eye on things, even when things are working. And the concluding paragraph to the book, as I have argued earlier, the local character of democracy can provide a crucial reality check on the conduct of national politics and governments, perhaps even inhibit the elite's temptation to foreign adventures. But that will require serious changes in the quality of public discussion, which in turn would depend upon the reclamation of public ownership of the airwaves and encouragement of non-commercial broadcasting. This contemporary version of the old struggle between enclosure and the commons, between exploitation and commonality, pretty much sums up the stakes. Not what new powers we can bring into the world, but what hard-won practices we can prevent from disappearing. So he highlights enclosure versus commons and exploitation versus commonality. And I would just add that while the small scale is, of course, important and a way to feel like one can make change, we cannot, I don't think we cannot overlook or neglect the large scale as well, because the stakes are too high, and you know, small victories can happen while there's wider troubles. So it's just you know, we can applaud each small victory, yes, but I think we need to look at both and not see them as distinct, but see how they, you know, connect literally and sometimes very subtly. How they connect blatantly, what I mean by literal, and sometimes very subtly, or it won't show up for a long range. So thank you very much for listening to this series. And again, it's a fascinating book. Definitely take some sitting down and thinking about it. I typically had to stop a few pages and kind of figure out, you know, think about it, and but then go right back to it. So it's a good read if you have the time and really want to delve into it more deeply. Once again, thanks to the Princeton University Press, and a tip of the hat to Sheldon S. Wolin for Democracy Incorporated, Managed Democracy, and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism. So thanks again for listening. Have a good one. And we'll go out with a song by Steely Dan here at the Western World.